Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 09-1231 et al. Braintree Electric Light Department et al. Petitioners versus Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Mr. Coyle for petitioners, Ms. Banta for respondent.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is John Coyle of the firm Duncan and Allen, here representing petitioners, Braintree Electric Light Department et al. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal, if I might. This case involves a formula rate under the Independent System Operator New England Transmission Markets and Services Tariff, in which costs that are accumulated under a definition contained in Section 3.6.1 of the tariff form the numerator and are allocated in the manner described in Section 3.6.4.4. As boring as that sounds, it's not a bad framework for evaluating the issues in the case. And for the court's reference, the numerator language is quoted at page 6, footnote 3 of petitioner's opening brief, and the denominator definition language is quoted at page 45, footnote 10. Let me start with the numerator issues. One set of numerator issues concerns petitioner's challenge to the inputs used by ISO New England in the numerator of the rate in regard to allocating the costs of operating two relatively old and inefficient generating units, totaling one commissioned in 1968 and the other in 1975, totaling about 1,100 megawatts of generating capacity, and whether that was appropriately included under this formula rate. The critical document in the record for your consideration of this set of issues is the so-called short-term report prepared by ISO New England under the terms of a settlement agreement that I will describe shortly. You'll find the short-term report in Volume 1 of the appendix beginning at page 148. The discussion of post-first contingency switching, which is the significant subject in this case, appears at Volume 1 of the Joint Appendix, pages 162 through 164.
You know, it would help me, actually, if we start with the settlement agreement, and if we could first see if we could figure out if FERC were right about its interpretation, which arguments remain, and then move on to the question of if FERC is wrong, and some of what you're saying goes to what happens if FERC is wrong. So as I understand FERC's argument, there are two things left for you. One is to challenge, and I'm reading from the final order, the LSCPR charges that would have been reduced if the owners had instead implemented a switching or special protection arrangement. And second, whether the commission should direct a change in the ISO any New England definition of SEMA.
Correct.
Right? That's what they held the settlement agreement means.
Correct.
And if you could focus on the second one for one moment, whether the commission should direct a change. They say that no party continued to advocate a change in the definition of the SEMA boundary as permitted by the settlement agreement. So just assume for the moment that they're right. Well, then I'm happy to let you go on with the assumption that they're wrong, but in my own mind, I have to see the difference between these. If they're right as to the meaning of the agreement, what is your argument on each of these two points, but starting on the second point?
Starting with the second point, Your Honor, our point is that the boundaries of the SEMA region could be changed anywhere from the refund effective date until the change was no longer necessary. That was relief that we were entitled to seek under Section 7.2 of the settlement agreement. It was relief that we thought the FERC had set for hearing when in its July 18, 2008 order, it set the issue of whether the boundaries continued to be a just and reasonable basis for allocating these costs.
Well, was that your request for sort of hypothetical retroactive relief? Is that what that was for?
I guess it's been characterized as retroactive relief, Your Honor. We don't regard it as retroactive.
The commission's view was the settlement agreement barred you from seeking that.
The commission's view is it's difficult for me to speak for the commission. The view that they expressed was that we waived a lot of rights and that absent an ongoing redefinition of the boundaries of the SEMA region that we did not reserve a right to argue that the boundary should be adjusted temporarily, I think, right, is the politest way to put it.
Well, now, if they're right about that, then what's the answer to Judge Garland's question about this issue? Did you seek a prospective? You didn't.
At the time, excuse me, Your Honor, at the time we filed, we did, because it was uncertain when, if ever, the transmission problem that was causing these costs to be accumulated would be fixed. Whether the problem, the underlying problem in the transmission system was fixed or not, our view at the time the settlement agreement was executed, at the time the complaint was filed, and today, is that we properly reserve the right to litigate whether those boundaries appropriately allocated costs to us at any time after January 1, 2008, which was the time bar that was written into the settlement agreement.
But when FERC says no party continued to advocate a change in the definition, what do they mean? What do you think they mean by that? And is that accurate?
What they mean is that we're now dealing with what's called a locked-in period, Your Honor, for refund purposes, and that the transmission problem that was causing the accumulation of these costs, which problem, sort of the essence of the case, did not affect my clients. Had the transmission system failed to operate in the manner that it was feared it would, my clients would not have been affected by the failure. And our theory was it's therefore unjust and unreasonable to allocate costs to us.
No, I got that.
In contemplation of that.
They're correct that you're not asking for a prospective change from now on, whatever, a change in the region, right? You're only asking for it as if it occurred during the locked-in period.
That's essentially correct, Your Honor. As of September 2009, upgrades had been made to the transmission system that solved the problem that was the source of this cost.
So there, and you understand their argument to be that you had to, in order to come under the second category of items that you had saved, you had to be arguing for a prospective change that would affect not only the locked-in period but then on. Is that right? Your understanding of what FERC said.
I do. I don't think it's a correct reading of the agreement.
I got that. and the provision of the agreement we're talking about then is the 7.21, which provides that the municipals may seek such a change, that is a change in the definition of the region.
In the ISO New England
become effective
definition.
No earlier than January 1st, 2008.
Correct.
Okay. I got you. Thank you.
The text of the settlement agreement, if you want to focus on it, does not bear the limitation that FERC attempts to place on it. A change in the definition of the SEMA reliability region could be temporary, could be transitory. In fact, there was a transitory redefinition of the analogous load zone, where ISO New England actually did recognize the lower SEMA interface for some purposes. And our point simply was they should have recognized it for these purposes as well. As the court is no doubt aware, there's kind of a paucity of definitional content to the term reliability region. It's whatever appears on the ISO's website, and essentially, if I distill it to its essence. There's a summary of the definitional issue in the joint appendix at page 662. If you want to check it out, it's a good sort of catch-all to find all the terms. But in essence, a reliability region is whatever ISO New England says it is on its website. So in view of the lack of definitional content, it doesn't take a great leap to say, okay, redefine it so that it allocates costs to those parties who are affected by the problem you're trying to prevent, and does not allocate costs to those parties who are not affected by the problem you're trying to
prevent. You would have a different reliability region depending on a particular item of cost?
Your Honor, we're dealing with a formula rate here. You're dealing with a formula rate top and bottom. And so the cost allocation depends on the input. I'm not seeking a change in the rate. I'm seeking a change in the inputs. So as the court knows, in a formula rate, The formula is the rate. What's at issue in this case are inputs into the rate.
Which language in the settlement agreement permits you to make that argument? That is, I understand FERC's argument to be that that's not one of the arguments that's reserved. I'm at least right about what FERC's position is, right?
You are. Right. I'm not. All right. I might fight you on a lot of other things, Your Honor, but I'm not fighting you on that one.
Okay. So their argument is that only two things are reserved by the for litigation. And one is about the alternatives to the LSPCR, and the other is about the definition of the region.
Right.
Now, the things you're talking about just now, which is the inputs to the formula,
right,
at least those words are not contained in the reservations.
Well, Your Honor, 7.1 is about the numerator, and 7.2 is about the denominator. 7.1 discusses what goes into the numerator of the fraction, the LSCPR costs, and we are allowed to challenge those on the basis that they would have been or should be reduced by using, in this case, post-first contingency switching. 7.2 is in essence the denominator of the fraction, allocation of the costs over all loads in the reliability region. Our point was simply that input needed to be changed with
respect. Which input? Are you talking about 7.2?
7.2, correct. Allocation over the reliability region.
It doesn't say allocation. It just says the parties may seek a change.
Correct.
To the definition of the reliability region.
Correct. A change to the definition of the reliability region would be a change to the denominator of the fraction, or the input to the denominator of the fraction for this particular cost.
Okay.
Now, the substance of what I think is bothering you, and it's chewed up an awful lot of paper in this case, is whether we reserve the right to seek financial relief. In substance, and I want to suggest to you that you cannot
financial relief other than by these two narrow ways in which you could do it.
I think a better way to put it is whether we reserve the right to seek financial relief in a manner as narrow as FERC said we did. The two theories we agree we're constrained by the settlement agreement on, but we are not as constrained as FERC says. If you look at section 4.1 of the settlement agreement, section 8C, 9.2, 9.5B, 10.1, all of those provisions of the settlement agreement contemplate that we are able to seek a reallocation of canal local second contingency protection resource costs.
Well, FERC seems to agree with you that this moratorium is subject to 7.1, but they seem to disagree with you in terms of what that covers. And so I guess the question really is, I assume you don't agree with them,
right?
But are you saying that this is ambiguous, or do you think under its plain terms it means what you think it means?
Under its plain terms, Your Honor, no party has asserted ambiguity with respect to the contract, which means, with respect to the settlement agreement, which means, in my appreciation, the court's review is essentially de novo. You enforce the contract, the agreement, in accordance with its plain language.
Well, let me ask you about that, because the key to this seems to be that phrase, could be or should be implemented, right?
That's 7.1, yes. Yep. And you're...
And you don't think that there's any ambiguity in that phrase?
No. It could be or should be implemented? There is not, Your Honor. There was a process that was laid out. ISO New England conducted its study. It came back with the short-term report, which, as I noted, appears beginning at page 148, and the relevant portion of it appears at pages 162 through 164 of the appendix. ISO New England said there is a switching solution that can technically be implemented at region-wide loads up to 17,000 megawatts, which we adduced evidence in support of in our complaint, said that's about 30% of the time. Okay? And the FERC, the commission, says that would unacceptably degrade reliability. May well. from FERC's perspective, if the ISO wants extra protection for loads in a particular area, they're empowered to order it. They cannot allocate the costs of it through the formula that's at issue in this case. That's the problem. So it's not a question of ambiguity about the terms.
The section that we're talking about says whether consistent with applicable criteria, which I think could be reliability criteria.
The short-term report found that the switching scheme is consistent with applicable criteria.
It said it's consistent with 30%, which means if you go above that, the system crashes. So how does that make it consistent with?
It is consistent with for that period of time, Your Honor.
Right, but what set that period of time as the key?
This is a daily accumulation of charges, okay? The formula rate accumulates charges on a daily basis.
I'm interested in the, just for the moment, in order to understand this, at least on its face, it looks to me like consistent with applicable reliability criteria, could we substitute these LSPCRs and place instead the SPS or the post-first contingency switching, right?
Yes.
Yes. And the result was, even on your explanation,
yep,
that, and what is it, above 30% of the time,
right,
you'd have to blackout.
No. Well, no. And that's an important distinction. Blackout has been used as a shibboleth in this case.
I mean it as a shibboleth. I mean it, the light's going out.
I understand. I understand what you mean. I would like not to see the court's attention diverted from what's going on by sloganeering. What would happen is what is necessary during the period of time that the region-wide loads are below 17,000 megawatts, you use a switching scheme instead of operating these two old inefficient units out of economic merit. When the load goes above 17,000, we would agree you need to operate those units, and we can be charged for it. Or there's some other threshold. You know, the threshold was never actually litigated because FERC ruled against us summarily, but the evidence in support of our complaint said 30% of the time, based on the ISO's finding that a post-first contingency switching was adequate to meet the applicable criteria, we shouldn't be charged. So that was that part of it. The other 70% of the time, hypothetically, sure, you run them. And if you don't feel sufficiently secure in the 30% of the time when post-first contingency switching is adequate to render the necessary protection, order up something else. But you can't charge us for the something else. Why? Because the tariff limits the charge to those resources which are necessary. I'm way out of time.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Ms. Mander, before you start, I was wondering if maybe our court crier could, somebody could make a phone call about getting some air conditioning in the courtroom. What do you think?
There are actually people who they're trying to figure
out. Are they?
Fix it.
Okay. Maybe we're having a blackout. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Good morning. I'm Carol Banta for the Commission. I don't think the Commission will make jokes about blackouts, but the Court is certainly entitled to. beginning with this last point, I would first direct the Court's attention to JA 592, paragraph 25 of the first rehearing order. The Commission says this numerous places, but I think it's especially condensed here.
JA what?
JA 592. It's in the 2009 rehearing order at paragraph 25. It's recapping what it had found in the first order and then reaffirming it. The Commission didn't break this down in terms of what you could do or should do, because you're right, Judge Garland, the settlement, section 7.1, says consistent with applicable criteria. And the Commission in three of these orders, at least the first two, looked at what those applicable criteria would be and said in paragraph 25, the Commission found that the SPS and PFCS plans lacking because they involved an unacceptable risk of forced outage after the first contingency and would be inconsistent with applicable planning criteria. So the commission wasn't saying what you could do or should do. The commission said you couldn't do it consistent with the applicable criteria. That was the commission's finding without regard to how the ISO broke down could versus should in its short-term report. So that was the commission's finding.
In response to his argument that it would be reliable to not use it below 17, they're saying that you can't break it down that way.
That's right, because and I can't find, I wasn't able to find the exact site in the last couple of minutes, but I know that in, I think it's in the first order, in the order that the commission was looking at the four sources that you have going into Cape Cod. You have the two 345 kilovolt lines and the two canal units. And the evidence was that to serve even a low load, I believe your second contingency, your post, your planning for what happens in the second contingency still required a canal unit. Because say the first contingency is one of the 345 kilovolt lines being disabled. You then are trying to serve even a low load, not the peak 950 megawatt load, even trying to serve the lower load, you're serving it with one line. And if that line goes out, which is the second contingency, you would then be looking at load shedding. And I will say blackout, because that's what a forced outage is. Load shedding doesn't always have to be a blackout, because you, in other areas, you can juggle the power around to other lines and switches. But in the context of this setup, as it was before the transmission upgrades,
to be clear,
meant
this argument you're making now is in one of the four orders?
It is. I mean,
it's hard to read through them while you're sitting there. I appreciate that. It's
even
harder at my desk, but I'm sure it's hard sitting there.
I can point you to the right direction. I just wasn't finding the exact.
I'll find it. Now,
paragraph 24 in the first order has these megawatts that I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Somewhere in the orders, I know the commission said you would be looking at load shedding as your next step in case of second contingency at all load levels.
Now if I could just ask you just the same question that I began with opposing counsel, which is whether I'm understanding FERC's interpretation of the settlement agreement correctly.
Right.
That is that there are only two kinds of litigation rights reserved. One is that one of them is the subject that we're talking about now.
Right.
Which is to challenge the LSPCR charges that would have been reduced if they had instead implemented a switching or a special protection arrangement, right? Mm-hmm. And the second one was whether the commission should direct a change in the definition of SEMA.
Right. And I would like to clarify a question that Your Honor had earlier. The commission didn't say that the right under 7.2 was only to seek perspective.
This is the part I don't understand. So
right.
Please go right ahead.
Okay. At the time that the municipals filed their complaint, the running of the canal units was ongoing. The upgrades were in process, but not yet to the point where they became in 2009. And so when they filed seeking a change in the boundary, the commission wasn't looking at this as prospective versus retrospective. It was looking at should the boundary be changed. It referred that to the stakeholder process.
And at that point, that was within their reserved right.
Yes.
Yes. Okay.
And I don't think the commission ever said that the retrospective change in boundary was not reserved. What happened?
What does this mean then in the rehearing denial paragraph? Paragraph 17, the commission says, it says that the municipals failed to support their assertion that the settlement agreement permits them to seek reallocation of costs based on the premise that the boundaries should have been changed.
Right. Well, here's what I was getting to just next.
Isn't that what that means?
That's the way it played out in the end, but the commission did it because they had not gotten the boundary change. They went to the stakeholder process, the municipals, or everyone went to the stakeholder process as the commission directed. The stakeholder process looked at whether the boundary should be changed at any point, prospective or retrospective. Everyone agreed not to do it prospectively because by the time of the conclusion of the stakeholder process, the upgrades were in place and there was no problem. So the stakeholder process also looked at whether to do it retrospectively and decided not to for a variety of reasons, including that we can discuss that are in the orders, including notice and making changes based on temporary conditions. And the stakeholder process, the vast majority of the stakeholders said, no, we should not change it retrospectively. And the commission agreed with that. having agreed that the boundaries should not be changed retrospectively, and that was on the merits of that decision. Having agreed with that decision, the commission said that the municipals were bound from seeking reallocation for some other reason, having lost their boundary challenge. I may be confusing this more than it needs to be, but.
Yes.
Yes. I probably should have just agreed.
You don't know whether it's more than needs to be. That's the problem. Yeah.
Okay. Well, the reason, what the commission was saying was bound is you have not persuaded us, the commission, that the boundary should be changed for the retrospective locked-in period.
Should have been changed. For that period.
Should have been changed. That's right. You have not persuaded us. We agree with the outcome of the stakeholder process for the reasons.
Commission says that the municipalities failed to support their assertion that the settlement permits them to seek a retrospective. In other words, I read this sentence as the commission saying, under the settlement agreement, they could not seek a retrospective, not that they weren't entitled to it, but that they couldn't seek it under the settlement.
Can I just pause for one, just tell which paragraph are you on?
70.
Oh, it's JA 858, paragraph 17, continuing to the next page.
That's the second?
This is the very last order in the series, the 2010 rehearing
final
order.
The final order.
The final order.
The fourth one.
Denial of rehearing.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the short answer, I hope, to your question, the key word is there is to seek a reallocation. They were seeking a reallocation 17. Having failed to prevail on their boundary claim that they had preserved. They had preserved the right to seek a change in the boundary. They had failed to persuade the stakeholders and the commission that the boundary should be changed retrospectively, because of course no one was asking for it prospectively. But having failed to persuade the commission that the boundary should have been changed, they were seeking reallocation anyway.
Okay, but that's not what paragraph 17 says.
It says that they failed to support their assertion that the settlement permits them to seek a reallocation.
Yeah. Right.
Based on the premise that the boundary should have been changed. And the commission goes on to say in paragraph, well, the commission says that again in paragraph 21, but the commission says, again, I can't come up with the exact language in the order, but the commission said that you did not preserve the right to seek reallocation of the charges based on that based on saying that the boundary should have been changed after you failed to persuade us to change the boundary. Absent a boundary change, you do not have a reallocation claim. I hope.
And so you think if we look through this, we'll find that sentence somewhere that says that?
I know we said it in our brief, and
yeah,
I, yeah.
Really
but that's why the commission kept putting should have been changed in paragraph 21, paragraph 17.
Why don't you, when we're done, maybe you could just, maybe when counsel's done with his rebuttal, you could tell us where this is in the order, okay?
I will, yes, because we say the same things numerous times in here, and it's a little hard to track down which time we said it that way.
I'm sorry, go ahead. No, go ahead.
Can I go back to the beginning of this? We've been talking about the change in the boundary.
Yes.
But there's another argument that they seem to be making on cost allocation, which has to do with this, what we were talking about earlier, and the numerator, I guess, denominator. But their argument seems to be, we're not asking you to implement that where you say there would be unacceptable load shedding. We just want the benefit of that as a cost allocation. And as I understand it, the commission says no because the settlement agreement precludes that argument.
I think that's right. But the commission also, I think, just didn't take the premise that we would imagine whether you could set up the system. The commission looked and said you couldn't do your contingency planning this way applicable with consistent with the applicable criteria. So I think the idea that
They're trying to say the tariff says it has to be necessary.
And that's
if we've established that it's in fact not necessary, then you know how can that be okay under the tariff? And so that's I'm trying to understand how the commission dismissed that, because the commission doesn't really answer that question. It just says you can't argue this.
Well, it didn't. The commission said that
it didn't. Or
hmm? No, I'm sorry, the commission, I believe...
Answer to that was that it was beyond the settlement agreement.
That's what I mean. That by saying it was precluded because it wasn't within the scope of what was reserved in 7.1, the commission was not going to parse necessary and what that means and did find that to be barred by the settlement. And that is, for instance, paragraph 27 in the 2009 rehearing order. It's at JA 593. Is one of several places where the commission said we're not getting into necessary.
The commission says that. Well, what I'm trying to understand, both sides say it's not at all ambiguous, and both sides reach a completely different conclusion about what that means. So I guess what I'm trying to figure out is how does the commission, you know, what language is the commission relying on to say you can't argue about this?
Sure. And I don't know that the commission ever said whether it thought that the contract was plain or ambiguous. It just interpreted it. And what it did, it certainly looked at the various provisions that Mr. Coyle cited, the Section 4 and Section 8, that have a general moratorium on reallocation and reclassification issues. And every place where it says subject to Section 7, you look at Section 7. Section 7 is very specific about two narrowly defined claims in 7.1 and 7.2. And so the commission very much relied on what did Section 7.1 give you, or what did you retain for yourself in 7.1? And so the commission stayed within the boundaries of what was reserved in Section 7. So when it says you reserved in 7.1 the could or should with regard to this very specific switching alternative, that's it. There's nothing in Section 7 that says we're going to litigate what necessary means and whether this was necessary and whether we would reallocate it even though we would never, even though we don't think you could do this consistent with the applicable criteria. That's the end of 7.1 in the commission's view.
Suppose we don't think it's unambiguous. What do we do then?
If you don't think it's
unambiguous, we have to send it back to the commission, right?
Because the commission did not say this is plain. Yeah. This is I believe that you could defer to the commission's interpretation of the contract under the circumstances.
Even if we didn't know whether the commission thought it was clear or ambiguous.
I believe so, because the commission just it doesn't always say, we say this is plain, we say this is ambiguous.
It may not say that, but in terms of our review,
right.
I'm not quite sure how.
I
don't know whether the commission was exercising its authority to interpret ambiguous language.
Well, we have cases that say if the agency says it's absolutely clear,
right,
and we think it's not, then we send it back. But
right.
We don't have any cases on the subject of when the agency just goes ahead. Right, and the reason for the former cases are Chevron deference,
right.
And the agency has to realize that it can make this choice.
Right.
I don't know. This looks pretty ambiguous to everybody. It's hard to imagine it didn't look ambiguous to the agency.
I think that's right.
I'm still having trouble understanding this. What you just said. I thought I had it until you explained it.
Which part? Oh,
which was the SEMA region.
The SEMA region.
Yeah, so at paragraph 39 of the final order, of the final of the four orders, it says, no party continued to advocate a change in the definition of the SEMA boundary as permitted by the SEMA settlement section 7.2. Now, I had understood that to mean, and I think this was sort of what Judge Tatel was on also, that whatever they were asking for with respect to the change in the definition of the boundary at this point, which call it retrospective, call it hypothetical, whatever you want, it did not come within the settlement. And that the only thing that came within the settlement was a redefinition to become effective in whatever that year is, January 2008 or after, and then thereafter. Now, are you telling...
Oh!
What do you understand this? You're telling me that that's... What do you understand? Let me just... Let's not have a leading question. I'll give you an open question here. What does this mean? No party continued to advocate a change as permitted by the SEMA settlement. What does that mean?
Right. In they filed their complaint in March 2008, seeking a change as of right then. By the time it came through the stakeholder process in about June or July of 2009, the upgrades were in place and making a difference. And at that point, all the parties in the stakeholder process agreed that from 2009 forward, we didn't need to change the boundaries of this region. The municipals still wanted a change from March 2008 to July 2009. When we say retrospective, we're not talking about before,
Okay, the lock-in period.
The lock-in period.
Yes. Okay.
And the stakeholder process considered whether it would make any sense to change the boundary for the locked-in period and said no, based on notice and risk premiums and the various rationales that are outlined in the second couple of orders. So the stakeholder process said, no, let's not change the boundary for the locked-in period either.
Yes.
So no one wants it going forward, and we're not doing it for the locked-in period. Yes. And the commission agreed, did its own independent review, and agreed. That's the end of the story. If you're still seeking reallocation based on principles of cost causation or whatever, the boundary change is over. They're just seeking reallocation without the boundary change.
They're disagreeing. I'm not following that. So they're disagreeing with what happened in the stakeholder poll.
Yes.
Yes. And yet the agency doesn't say, well, they're disagreeing. We'll consider that. They do say that later. We're considering that disagreement, and we're sticking with the stakeholder policy. In this sentence, they say, no party continued to advocate a change in the definition of the boundary as permitted by the settlement. So I took that to mean that what they're now arguing, that is, that the stakeholders were wrong about the lock-in period, it does not come within the terms of the settlement, that they can't make that argument under the settlement, that the only argument they can make under the settlement is a now and going forward, or 2008 and going forward, or whatever, but they can't limit their argument to one period. Now, if that's not what it means, what does it mean to say that no party continued to advocate a change as permitted by the settlement?
Yeah, I guess I had understood it to mean that they were, that the commission, while responding on the merits to why we're not directing a change in the boundary for the lock-in period, forecloses any other reallocation argument.
But this is not a reallocation argument. It's an advocate a change in the definition of the
right.
boundary.
Well, I think that this actually, if you look at paragraph 38 and 37 and 36, that paragraph 39 is actually a continuation. There was another reallocation argument that the municipals made that followed from the could or should, the 7.1. If you look at this, contrary to municipal's assertion, the commission did not improperly avoid consideration of the out-of-merit dispatch costs and resulting benefits. The arguments kind of melded together at this point, but if you look at the paragraphs that led up to that, the commission was once again reaffirming its reliability criteria holding and saying that the ISO had properly continued to operate the canal units for reliability purposes. Now we've gotten to the point of the upgrades, so that doesn't have to happen anymore, but we're not going to go back and reallocate. There was a reallocation argument that, especially in some of the later filings, that the municipals were making with regard to the 7.1 could or should necessary arguments.
Yeah,
and that's where I think it gets muddy.
Well, the problem is they're referring to Section 7.2. That makes it hard to say that this is a sentence about Section 7.1.
That's because 7.2 was the only avenue that the commission had seen for reallocation. The two things under the Section 7 were reducing, if they prevailed under 7.1 and you reduced the LSCPR charges because you could or should have, you could have done a switching arrangement, that would come out of the charges for everyone. That wasn't an allocation cost causation argument. That was, as Mr. Coyle said, I think that's a numerator issue. But in the filings at this point, the municipals were asking for reallocation, and they were asking for it in the reliability part. These two issues weren't as neatly separated. And the commission was saying, we're only dealing with reallocation in the context of the boundary change issue that's under 7.2. We go on to deal with that. We go on to explain why We don't think the boundaries need to be changed, and that's it. That's the end of it at that point. I think that's what's going on in 39. If you look at where it comes through the reasoning of paragraph 35, 36, 37, where the commission is again going to the switching arrangement arguments, that 39 seems to follow from those, I think.
Okay.
I just want to take you back to this question of how we're supposed to look at this ambiguity question.
Right.
Mr. Coyle said that no one took the position that this settlement agreement was ambiguous. But what I hear you saying is, hey, all you have to do is look at it and see, and I guess we've spent so much time on it this morning, maybe it is ambiguous, and we should just assume that the commission thought it was ambiguous and was interpreting the language. Is that
I think so. I've certainly seen orders where the commission says the contract is plain, and here it really just launched into a contract interpretation. Uh-huh. And I agree that there is some play in the could or should language. So I know, I believe that the commission treated it as ambiguous, but it did not say specifically.
That's ambiguous itself, right?
Right.
All right, well, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's see, Mr. Coyle, you're out of time, but you can have 3 minutes, which will give Ms. Banta time to find us that site to the JA. Okay?
Thank you, Your Honor.
what do you think about this issue we just were talking about?
Your Honor, I've had occasion to do jury trials in contract cases where I do it this way. Every contract case is about two contracts, the one somebody signed and the one they wishes they the one they wish they signed. Yeah. That does not create ambiguity.
You think this contract's unambiguous?
I agree. Yes.
The commission thought that also?
Yes.
And what makes you think that?
Because the commission nowhere professes any doubt. Now, let me be more precise. Ambiguity in a contract sense is well understood to mean that there is a term or terms that are objectively reasonably susceptible to more than one interpretation, right? That is the classic definition of ambiguity. I invite the court's attention to your decision in Southern California Edison versus FERC 502 Fed 3rd 176, which I think is a pretty good summary of the law on this point. Neither we nor the commission took the position that there was any possibility of two objectively reasonable interpretations of the language at issue. They said, you're wrong, and we said, excuse us, you're wrong. That's not ambiguity. That's a dispute over meaning. What we have here is contract language that, while it's complicated, is plain. And if that answers your question, Judge Tatel, I'd like to go back to something that Judge Brown was asking about the question of the commission finding that we were somehow foreclosed by the settlement agreement from seeking reallocation of costs. The commission's contract interpretation with respect to the settlement agreement rests in its entirety on reading out reservations of rights that we carefully put in every waiver provision in that contract. If you go back to section 4.1, which the commission relies on heavily, 4.1 in its entirety is subject to section 7. It means it so much, it says it twice. It says it in the first sentence.
I don't understand FERC to be disagreeing on that point. In every case, they look at Section 7 and explain what your rights are based on their reading of Section 7. So,
Your Honor,
you're both on the same page on that. It's just you disagree on what Section 7 means.
And I think, to cut it a little finer for you, we stated it in the brief as FERC reads Subject 2 out of the settlement agreement, which is accurate. But if you take a look at the other provisions of the settlement agreement that I referenced, beyond Section 4.1, Section 8C, Section 9.2, Section 9.5B, and to get right to the chase, Section 10.1 says, in this settlement agreement, subject to the rights reserved to the municipals in Section 7, the parties are agreeing that they will not challenge ISO New England's flagging of canal as LSCPR. That language says, as plain as day, that Section 7 gives us the right to challenge the designation of...
As plain as day is subject to whatever Section 7 reserves for you, you can challenge.
But you wouldn't put that reservation in Section 10.1 if Section 7 didn't give you that right, Your Honor. That's my point.
Thank you. Well, Ms. Bantu, do you have that? Do you have a cite for us?
Yes. As I recall, you were asking about the cite for all load conditions. Am I thinking of the right citation? That you'd be setting up for for load shedding at all load conditions?
No, we were looking for a site for the proposition that I'm not even sure I can restate what you said. I thought my question wasn't the commission ruling that seeking a retrospective redrawing of the boundaries was beyond the terms of the settlement, that it had not been reserved?
Right. We had a.
And you said no, that the commission's view was, since they weren't entitled to a prospective one, right?
I think that was the second thing I was...
Where's that say?
I don't have that one for you.
Okay. Well, thank you very much then.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you both. The case is submitted.